Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome or welcome back to Season 3 of the Logical Christian Podcast. I'm your Logical Christian, Dan Irwin. The Logical Christian Podcast is not here to tell you what to think. It's an exercise in how to think. Rather than just accept what we're being told with regard to current events, politics, science, religion, and everything else, we're going to stop the spin, ask questions, dive deep, and look at the world logically. And since logic is a gift from God, most importantly, we're going to look at it all as Christians. Links can be found in the show notes if you'd like to follow along. So with that, let's go be logical Christians. So before we start, just one note. There will not be a podcast next week. I'm going to take a little break over the Easter weekend. If you'd like, you could go back to either episode 26 or episodes 111 and 112 to hear the Easter account from the Bible, but with the twist that I did my best to pull together the information from all four Gospels, each having their own focus, their own emphasis, their own specific details, and then read it all as one account. Episode 111 and 112 is the same as episode 26, just split into two episodes, just FYI. And with that, I hope that you all have a wonderful Easter. He is risen indeed. Now, on with the show. We talk a lot about scientific things in this podcast because, frankly, I'm getting real tired of all you flat-earther, Bible-believing, gun-toting science deniers thinking that science is nothing but witchcraft and stuff. Science is real. Science is fascinating. Science is just the best. Unfortunately, before we talk about that science, we generally have to wade through whatever the heck it is all these other guys are reporting on that makes no sense whatsoever. On today's episode, first we're going to journey to the bottom of the sea, and then we're going to get just smoking hot, and finally, I'll tell you what the data on my spreadsheet says. So, take a deep breath and hold your nose. Then everyone face away from everyone else and strip down. It's going to get warm. And finally, prepare yourself to nerd out. Because according to the law of the conservation of podcastery, here we go. Okay, so I'm not sure if I should be embarrassed to admit this or not. But I was today years old when I learned that there are five oceans on the Earth. Now, please, someone tell me I'm not the only one here. I knew the Atlantic and Pacific. I mean, those are the easy ones, right? You could dig a little deeper. You have the Indian and the Arctic. Those are the other two that I remember. Did you know that in the year 2000, not only did we narrowly avert disaster from the Y2K apocalypse, but apparently the International Hydrographic Organization, without even asking me, decided to scoop together water around Antarctica, blatantly stealing water from the Pacific and Atlantic and Indian Oceans, like a common thief, and named it, no, not the Antarctica Ocean, which would make a lot of sense. No, it's now called the Southern Ocean, which automatically made it the fourth largest ocean in the world, kicking the poor Arctic Ocean off to fifth. I mean, he never did anything to anybody. Now, to make matters worse, not only did nobody ask me, they didn't even tell me. They didn't put up posters or send out mailers, no mass emails. I don't know, maybe it was in one of those robocalls I didn't answer. Yeah, five oceans. Simply amazing. Anyway, where I was heading before I discovered that little nugget was that the oceans are in themselves amazing. Did you know that they all connect? Did you know that they cover about 71% of the Earth's total surface? The surface area of the Pacific Ocean alone is about equal in size to all of the land area on the Earth. The average depth of the Pacific is over 13,000 feet. That's under 2.5 miles deep. But the deepest point is in the Mariana Trench near Japan at just under 36,000 feet deep. Which, if you think about it, is about the same as how high your general commercial jet flies. Think of it another way. The tallest mountain on Earth is Mount Everest at a few feet over 29,000 feet high. The deepest point in the Pacific is a mile deeper than Mount Everest is tall. That's a big hole. The Atlantic, not quite as impressive, that has an average depth of about the same, nearly 13,000 feet, and a deepest point in the Puerto Rico Trench at just over 28,000 feet deep. In fact, speaking of mountains, the longest mountain chain at nearly 35,000 miles long is called the Mid-Oceanic Ridge and runs along the center of the ocean basins. And finally, would you believe that we've only explored about 5% of the ocean. That leaves a lot of water that's unexplored. You ever wonder what might be down there? Well, there's a certain breed of human that does. I mean, like really does, loves that stuff. And I think we need to talk about some of the things they found. Let's start here. Found on livescience.com, headline, superstructure bigger than Idaho has been growing on the seafloor by Fiji since the dinosaur age. No, I have not been growing on the seafloor by Fiji since the dinosaur age. It's another something bigger than Idaho. Thank you very much. So there is a massive undersea plateau about 750 miles long, about 200 miles wide at its widest point, that, quote, first started forming with volcanic eruptions during the Cretaceous period, 145 to 66 million years ago, and it is still growing today. Don't you love how definite they are about that? They're so sure. Quote, in fact, the Melanesian border plateau located east of the Solomon Islands formed through four separate pulses of volcanism, all with different root causes, according to new research published January 15th in the journal Earth and Planetary Science Letters. And I think it goes without saying that that is my favorite science No, I'm not going to do that this time. But I mean, how many journals, so-called, are there? I kind of think that I could make up my own journal, set up a quick webpage, and I'd have people submitting stuff to me in, I don't know what, 3 minutes or less? So anyway, they claim to know that starting in a period 145 million years ago, there have been four volcanic events, all with different root causes, that created this plateau. That seems to me, I guess, like a bold claim. But as Kevin Conrad, a geoscientist at the University of Nevada, says, quote, this timeline is important because giant volcanic features under the ocean are often poorly understood. In some cases, they form in a single flood of magma, in which case they're known as large igneous provinces. These huge, long-lasting volcanic events are so dramatic that they often shift the climate and have been associated with mass extinctions. Do they? Have they? I feel like the meme guy shouting, source. Just listen to what he claims here. Quote, they often shift the climate. Really? How can you claim this? What exactly is your proof on this? Or is it just because you must throw in something about climate in order to call it science these days? And then, quote, have been associated with mass extinctions. Have they? Now look, I'm not an undersea volcanic activity expert, you might be shocked, nor am I a mass extinction expert. And maybe this is yet another Southern Ocean situation for me, but I don't know that I've ever heard large undersea volcanoes and mass extinction tied together directly like this before. No matter, that's not what we have here. What we have is something more like a layer cake, where multiple events have built on top of each other. When they build like this one, as luck would have it, they don't often shift the climate, and they aren't often associated with mass extinctions, so nobody panic. Yet. Here's the problem. Because of the fact that these are, you know, not easily accessible, being down on the bottom of the ocean, scientists are mostly guessing about this. No, he didn't say it like that. What he said is that often they have a single rock sample. So they might assume the big rock blobs are from a single event, but if they can go back and sample some more, you know, sample in detail, it's often found that they're layered, like that delicious cake we just spoke of. And they further know that these cake layers are built up over tens of millions of years, quote, and wouldn't have significant environmental impacts. Phew. The next paragraph starts, I think, in the most honest way I've ever read. Quote, Conrad and his collaborators. Now, I know what the author is saying, but she didn't say team. She didn't say fellow scientists. She said collaborators. And I don't know about you, but there's kind of a negative connotation to that word, isn't there? Like they're scheming something. Anyway, they started studying this plateau in 2013 by dredging rock from the slopes of the volcanoes and the plateau, and by doing that, they, quote, learned that the plateau likely first started forming 120 million years ago. Okay, now, listen to this timeline. Listen to what they're pretty sure happened based on dredging rock. And of course, analysis of the rock, right? And then we have an evolutionary timeline that shan't be questioned and an agenda. But based on the rock and those other things, listen to this timeline. So 120 million years ago, the base was laid down. This, quote, likely did not reach above sea level. How do they... That sat there, likely completely underwater, obviously, for about 75 million years, just sitting there. When 45 million years ago, that plateau on the drifting tectonic plate on which it sits drifted over a hot spot in the mantle of the Earth. You can read the details. Link is in the notes. But what they know for sure is that this actually formed an entire undersea mountain chain, and those definitely had peaks that rose above the water surface, creating islands. But as millions of years tends to do, by 13 million years ago, well, those islands had eroded away. But don't fret! Our tectonic plate, we shall call him Drifty McDriftyface, kept on truckin' and found itself over yet another hotspot. In fact, the very hotspot that is currently building the Samoan Islands. And that hotspot pumped magma up through the exact same conduits that the magma 45 million years went up through, and rising from the sea, new islands. Yay. But oh no. No. You better sit down for this. Those islands eroded away again also. But, 3 million years ago, underwater volcanoes erupted along the Tonga Trench, and so that built more of the plateau. And there you have it. The twisted, complicated, ironclad scientific timeline of 120 million years, all determined through the dredging of some rocks. And what's even more crazy is, quote, there are many hotspots in the South Pacific, Conrad said, so it's likely that other seamounts have been built over time in similarly complicated ways. Oh, be still my heart. Now, I want you to take a deep breath. Try to calm the excitement from that last one. Let's dive into it. See what I did there? Let's dive into another ocean story. Found on Indy100.com, headline, Strange Structures Discovered in the Pacific Could Change Our Understanding of Earth. Quote, scientists believe they found a window into the dawn of time on Earth and is hidden beneath the Pacific Ocean. Amazing! Why would you put a window under the Pacific Ocean? That just seems silly. I don't know. Who am I to talk? So this window is actually two windows. One window is actually on the land in a corner of South Africa, and the underwater windows off the coast of New Zealand. Quote, together, they shed light on the world in its infancy and offer unexpected clues about the origins of the planet we know today, and possibly life itself. Now, I'm not going to do this, but you know what one of you should do? Compile all the stories over, say, the last 50 years that claim to have possibly found the key to the start of life on Earth. I swear they found that stupid key hundreds of times. I mean, you'd think they'd have it figured out by now. Okay, so this section of land on South Africa has had scientists that are studying the region, for whatever reason, perplexed because the rock bed in that area, quote, is inconsistent with our widely accepted understanding of plate tectonics at the time. Now, I would say that maybe their widely accepted understanding is wrong. Get a new theory. But nay, in mapping this area, they actually found a fragment of the ancient deep sea floor that was created 3.3 billion years ago, quote, when the world was a mere 1.2 billion years old. Mere 1.2 billion years old. Can science not hear itself because they sound ridiculous? Anyway, the long-standing theory of the formation of the Earth is that the, early Earth, early on, when it was a mere 1.2 billion years old, well, the Earth was still kind of soft and magma-y, right? It was a blob that was still too soft for tectonic plates to smash into each other and create earthquakes. But these scientists, because evolution at this point is really just a choose-your-own-adventure book, say, no, the Earth was solid enough and just earthquaked all the flipping time. They think this because what they were looking at didn't make any sense, so they needed a new theory to make their theory work. They said that the bedrock they were analyzing was all jumbled up, throwing them for a loop, until they realized that it was very similar to the underwater landslides that have occurred near New Zealand along the largest fault for that country, where the bedrock is also a jumbled up mess. And that jumbled up mess was obviously laid down 20 million years ago when there was a lot of earthquake action. So, and now follow the logic with me, if you will. Since we know that the jumbled bedrock near New Zealand happened 20 million years ago as a result of all the earthquakes that we know were happening 20 million years ago, and we know that 20 million years ago the Earth was solid, which allowed for the earthquakes, and since the bedrock in South Africa exhibits the same jumbled traits, then we know that that too was the result of earthquakes. And we know that bedrock is from back when the Earth was a mere 1.2 billion years old. We ergo can conclude forthwith that the Earth, at a mere 1.2 billion years old, was hard enough to have bunches of earthquakes, completely upsetting science, which has been settled for millions of years. Boom! New science. But they weren't done. They also noted that these massive earthquakes would cause massive volcanic eruptions. Quote, they cite the example of Tonga's Hunga Tonga Hunga Hapai volcano, which erupted in January 2022 with the energy of a 60 megaton atomic bomb and sent a vast cloud of ash into space, through which over the subsequent 11 hours, more than 200,000 lightning strikes flashed. And since we know that the Earth was much harder, much more earthquakier, much earlier in life, causing more massive underwater volcanoes, blasting massive clouds of ash into the water, into the air, and we know this causes hundreds of thousands of lightning strikes, this could possibly be the source of lightning that we all know turned brackish gray water into life. Boom. Miracle of the evolution of life. Look, you can't say you're not learning. Just all kinds of stuff here. Okay, hold on to that one. We've got one more to go here. Found on sciencealert.com, headline, mysterious ancient megastructure discovered lurking beneath the Baltic Sea. No, I'm not lurking beneath the Baltic Sea. It's a different megastructure. Will you stop? In the Bay of Mecklenburg in Germany, about 70 feet below the surface of the water, there's a line of large stones nearly two-thirds of a mile long. They date this line of 1,670 stones, each one being give or take 3 feet high and 6 feet wide, set side by side to about 10,000 years ago. They evaluated the stone wall for a number of potential uses, prior, of course, to it being underwater, as I think we can all agree that it's highly unlikely people thousands of years ago were just setting massive stones in a big long line 70 feet underwater, and they believed that this wall would have been used for driving herds of animals, funneling them and trapping them for hunting purposes, most likely. They stated that these kinds of structures are found all over the world, on land, not underwater, at least that they know of, and they think this one was built, like I said, about 10,000 years ago and submerged about 8,500 years ago. Now, this, of course, happened because of, quote, tectonic movement, erosion, and climate processes such as glaciation and sea level changes. Can you hear that? It sounds like the jackpot at Vegas. He used the climate word. This article makes two fun comments. Well, fun for you and me. Quote, the structure defies natural explanation, meaning it seems to have been deliberately constructed for some purpose. And then, quote, "The consistency and neatness," the team says, "are unlikely to be the result of natural processes such as glacial transport or being pushed by ice." Why? Why can't natural processes do this? I guarantee that these same scientists would say that the Big Bang exploded and out of complete and utter chaos, the ordered universe came to be. That out of a chemical soup and lightning strikes, ordered cellular development came to be. That through natural processes, the eye came to be, the nervous system, heck, humans, animals, plants, insects, and everything else came about from disorder to unfathomable complex order through natural processes. But not a line of rocks? Seriously? I mean, again, I gotta ask, can science hear itself because it's just being silly at this point? Or are we being punked? I mean, that might be it too. All right. So what do you think? Some pretty fascinating stories, right? Some 10,000-year-old underwater wall, massive 120-million-year-old underwater plateau, and a 3.3-billion-year-old jumbled-up bedrock upsetting settled geological planetary evolutionary science that might have revealed the very origin of life on Earth. And I gotta ask, who cares? I mean, seriously, and I don't mean to be dismissive or demeaning or anything like that, but honestly, these scientists are studying an underwater plateau. Who cares? Bedrock in South Africa. Who cares? An ancient rock wall that's now underwater? Who cares? But at the same time, I look at my job as a reliability engineer for a chemical company. My dad worked a number of different jobs. My mom was primarily a homemaker, as was my sister until more recently, with grown kids. Kids who work in the animal, medical, and aerospace field. What about pro athletes? Missionary? Politician? Airplane mechanic? Construction worker? Shelf stocker? Teacher? Uber driver? Cashier? Greeter? Chef? Student? Who cares? And the answer is God. God cares. God cares deeply about our careers, our jobs, our hobbies, our volunteering. In whatever we do, we're to do it as if we're doing it for God. We're to do it giving all glory and praise to God, and we're to be thankful for whatever it is that God has blessed us to be able to do, no matter how complicated or how impactful or how trivial, per the world's definition, it may appear. A case in point, I do a lot of things that seem very trivial at work. Excel spreadsheets, filing reports, analyzing some data, all with the goal of making the chemical plant that I work in work more reliably so it can make more chemicals. Those chemicals go into various products. Those products impact various aspects of human life. And the only reason it really matters for anything is because there's a much larger meaning behind what I do. I'm doing it for God's plan and purpose, whatever that might be, in this world. And you should be thinking that as well. The only caveat I could think to what I just said is if you're doing something that violates God's word, right? You're an abortion doctor or a transmutilation doctor, a drug dealer, a prostitute, etc., etc. Or if you're doing something that violates your own conscience, but you're ignoring that and you're doing it anyway. And I'm not going to give any examples of that, as I don't want to put some undue burden on someone because of my theological worldview with regard to aspects of this world that are open for interpretation. Now, back to these three articles. The scientific team studying these three unique things, who cares? If you were able to corner them, how long would it take for you to get them to admit that from their naturalistic, godless worldview, whether that plateau is the result of one big event or a bunch of small ones, it really doesn't matter. Whether the planet was hard or soft at a mere 1.2 billion years old, really doesn't matter. Whether that wall was natural or man-made, or if it was a property boundary or a hunting blind, really doesn't matter. Beyond the curiosity and the excitement of discovery for that specific team, maybe a handful of others, nobody cares. It doesn't affect you or me. It doesn't change anything. Nobody cares. But from a Christian worldview, a biblical, young earth, Bible-believing Christian worldview, it does matter. You see, this jumbled up bedrock that doesn't seem to fit the model. Oh, let me tell you about a man named Noah and the power of our God who created this world, who destroyed this world, and who will actually destroy it once more in the future and rebuild it again. You better be ready. Those plateaus and mountain ranges underwater, did you know in the book of Psalms it says the valleys sunk down and the mountains rose up? Did you know that there are very solid biblical theories that a lot of that land could have swapped places at the end of the great flood? Those underwater mountains could have been mountains that stood proud and tall as part of original creation. Maybe, right? Granted, maybe. But also, maybe. That wall you see, could that be a place where the valley sunk down gently? Not everything everywhere had to be violently upended. Could that be due to the end of the Ice Age? The Ice Age that absolutely happened. We know it happened as most likely a result of the Great Flood. And as the ice receded and melted, the water level rose on a plot of ground that was walled off for whatever reason. Personally, I still see very little point in studying these kinds of things. But God put that drive and desire in the hearts of some to explore all aspects of His creation, regardless of what I think. Because even in the underwater volcanic rock plateaus, God's glory is on full display. But absent God, absent a biblical worldview, the question remains, who cares? The chief end of man, per the Westminster Shorter Catechism, is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. And that's in all things. We, humanity, can still do all those things, but if you remove God, you remove man's chief end, our ultimate purpose in this life, and then we're nothing but happy little evolutionary accidents, looking at other happy little evolutionary accidents, and then we die. You and I know better, though. So next time you dread getting up and going in and lifting that bale and toting that barge, ask yourself, who cares? Knowing the answer is God cares. And then get after it. Do whatever you're doing, glorifying God and enjoying Him forever. It is hot. I think we're all in agreement. Way too hot. I mean, it doesn't feel too hot, but it is. I mean, it's smoldering hot out there. In fact, found on MSN.com, it appears coming from CBS WBZ Channel 4 out of Boston. Headline, 2023 was warmest year on record. Startling new climate report says. Now, my first question is, was it really? Was it really startling? Because every month, every year is always the hottest ever. Should anyone be shocked at all when a report comes out saying it's the hottest year ever again? Because I kind of feel like most of humanity is like, oh, hottest, huh? Okay, anyway. So just a few days ago, the World Meteorological Organization, which I don't know how many of these organizations we have, but I'd be willing to say too many. What exactly are they all contributing to society at this point? And then I remember it's fear. So, you know, they're all mongering in fear. So the more that monger, the more perception of doom there is, and the more fear there is, the more general unthinking humanity will capitulate or even promote deadly, economically destructive, illogical actions that will put money in the pockets of, well, let's just call a spade here, in the pockets of evil humans. But that's neither here nor there. We have a State of Global Climate 2023 report that we need to look at. Now, the key message of this report sums up pretty much what the report is about, as key messages tend to do. First, the State of Global Climate report confirms 2023 as hottest year on record by clear margin. Next, records broken for ocean heat, sea level rise, Antarctic sea ice loss, and glacier retreat. Third, extreme weather undermines socioeconomic development. Point D, renewable energy transition provides hope. And Roman numeral 5, cost of climate inaction is higher than cost of climate action. Now, this is a 53-page report, and I think you and I should probably walk through it line by line. But to be honest, I think a lot of things, a lot of silly things, so we'll just disregard that thought. The bottom line is that everything we've been doing hasn't done anything and won't ever do anything, no matter what we do. So we definitely need to spend a lot more money and do more of the same things. So they have a nifty graph, all sorts of lines, all arcing upward, showing that in the pre-industrial world, the average global temperature was steady. And now 2023 is sitting at 1.45 degrees Celsius warmer, which for us USA Americans, that's like 2.6 degrees Fahrenheit. So somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 years after the pre-industrial world, it's 2.6 degrees Fahrenheit warmer on average, they say. Now, you may not think that's a big deal, but that's because you're a big stupid head. See, the Paris climate thingy says that a 1.5 degree C increase is the lower limit to, I think, irreversible doom, maybe? It's something like that. So we're in trouble here. But we still have 0.05 degrees C to go, so we're still fine. Except that the margin of error of that 1.45 degrees is plus or minus 0.12 degrees, so we may actually be sitting pretty or already in the doom spiral, they say. Of course, this inferno is due to mainly carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, which is a gas that's in the atmosphere naturally, accounting for about 0.04% of the entire atmosphere, not 99% like they would lead us to believe, you know, just less than one half of 0.1%, that's all. But of course that, with some nitrous oxide and some methane, are just boiling the planet to death. I'm preaching to the choir here, I know. Now keep in mind that CO2 is at the 0.04% level, like we said. Methane is at the 0.0015% level, and nitrous oxide doesn't even register in most of the charts that you see of what makes up the atmosphere, but those things are turning our planet into a smoldering ash heap. Now, you may wonder by how much those things are elevating, right? Well, from 1985 to 2023, CO2 has gone from 340 to 420 parts per million in our atmosphere. Methane moved from 1,650 parts per billion to 1,950, and nitrous oxide moved from 305 parts per billion to 335 parts per billion. I'm trying to think of how to make this make sense. So think of a football field, sideline to sideline, including both end zones. So it's 360 feet long, 160 feet wide. Carbon dioxide would fit in a square 5 feet by 5 feet. Methane would fit in a square about 4 inches by 4 inches. And nitrous oxide would fit in a square slightly less than 1 3/4 inches by 1 3/4 inches. And remember, that's the entire football field. Now, nitrogen takes up 78% of that field, and oxygen takes up 28%. Argon is nearly another percent. If you're doing the math at home, that's about 99%. So out of the 1% that's left, you know, that's CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, neon, helium, krypton, and possibly some other tons and ides and things. But that teeny tiny amount, if increased by even a teenier tinier amount, spells certain doom. Makes sense. And further, they believe that a global temperature increase of 1.5 degrees C spells certain doom because, I don't know, none of this makes any logical sense. And yes, I'm well aware of the experimental data, the theoretical data, and the climate models, and I'm calling bunk on all of it. And as if that wasn't bad enough, the oceans are committing treason as well. They're becoming unbelievably acidic, and they're heating up too. Well, not unbelievably acidic. I mean, they've allegedly moved in about 35 years from a pH of 8.11, which is slightly basic, as a pH of 7 is neutral, below 7 is on the acidic side, above 7 is basic. Well, it's moved from 8.11 to 8.05, which is also still slightly basic. For reference, a pH of 8 is the same as you'd find in a grape or corn, or a mushroom, or a banana. Now, granted, to change the pH of something as massive as an ocean, it would take a lot, but their graph is only a tiny chunk of time. On Nature.com, they have a graph going back to 1680. Of course, nearly all of that is nothing but guesswork, but they show that the pH from 1680 to about 1880 rose from 7.9 to 8.04. Then for some reason, about 1880 or 90, it dropped quickly to about 7.92 in just 30 years. And then it further dropped to about 7.9 by 2010. Also curiously, the concept of pH was introduced in 1909 and revised to our current understanding in 1924, and that's the exact time period that the Nature article shows the ocean's pH dropped dramatically. What a coincidence. But hold on, the Nature article shows that in 1985 the pH was 7.9. But this other report by the WMO said that in 1985 the pH was 8.11. So which is it? And that's the problem. That's the entire problem with all this. But let's look at one more data point, shall we? Arctic sea ice. We all know that we're losing all our ice. Polar bears are drowning, islands are submerged, and coastal cities are disappearing just left and right day after day. And this is happening around the world, except for every single place in the entire world where it's not happening at all. So the WMO has another graph, kind of a convoluted graph. They're graphing from January 2023 to January 2024, just a single year. They've got a single line for millions of square kilometers of Arctic ice for 2023. That's a color. They made that a single color. And as it does, it dips in the summer, which bottoms out in September, October, and peaks in the winter, which is around March or April. But then they have another line where they averaged 1991 to 2020 data as a single line. That's a different color line. Then they have lines for every year for 1979 all the way up through 2022. But all those lines are the same color. So you don't really know what year is what on this graph. But then they put a max line and a min line that bounds it by kind of connecting the dots for the highest and the lowest points for each year. This really, in general, makes no sense. In no way would anyone ever seriously look at this kind of data this way. But they're saying that we're hitting record lows in Arctic ice. Well, from what I can see, it appears that 2023 was running on the low side, but within the boundaries of the mass of data for the first few months of 2023. Then it met up with the average line of 1991 to 2020 for a few months. Then it dipped low again, still within the data boundaries. Then in the second half of the year, it picked back up and it ended the year exactly where the 91 and 2020 average was sitting. Plainly stated, the Arctic ice is doing exactly what the Arctic ice has always done. Now, here's the thing, though. Whether it's atmospheric gases, global temperatures, oceanic temperatures, ocean pH, or sea ice, says who? They're measuring, but time and time again, the measurements have been proven faulty. For instance, some of the atmospheric temperature stations are located on black roofs or at the outlet of large AC exchangers with hot air blowing on them. The pH is clearly nothing but guesswork until we could actually measure it. And even now, apparently, the measurements depend on who's doing it, or probably more accurately, why they're doing it. We were told decades ago that we'd have no more ice by now, but we have the same basic average amount of sea ice that we've had for 45 years. And this is the problem with all these so-called scientific measurements. Says who? Who do they work for? Where does the funding come from? And how are they measuring it? The Bible tells us not to have dishonest scales. They're an abomination, and that's exactly what this is. These are dishonest scales. To do science, we must be able to trust the data. Data gathered and reported by climate scientists who are being funded by public or private organizations with economic and political stakes in the game, I'm sorry, but they can't be trusted, or at least not without some very strict verification. And as we've discussed in the past, the peer review process is nothing but a joke at this point, so there is no verification. Money is very powerful, especially when you're dealing with individuals who have no connection to biblical morals. You know, don't bite the hand that feeds you, even if you have to adjust the data. Anytime the data is made to fit a conclusion, rather than drawing a conclusion from the data, well, we've got a really big problem on our hands. And that's mainstream climate science in a nutshell, right there. But this narrative is quite useful, or quite compelling, depending on if you literally believe this tripe or if you believe in what this tripe is pushing and what it can do for you. For instance, toward the end of October 2023, we find on APnews.com headline, Arizona's Maricopa County has a new record for heat-associated deaths after the hottest summer. So not the United States, not Arizona, a county. Now, granted, it's the largest county by population, making up over half of the total population of Arizona, but it's still a single county. So as of October, the claim is that there were 425 related deaths due to heat. at that point in October, which was the same number as all of 2022. So see, climate change. And here's the scary thing. That's a 20% increase in theory. So doing some quick calculations, a 20% increase in heat deaths every single year means that all of the 4.x million residents of Maricopa County will have died by heat by 2063. And that's sad. And that is legitimate climate science, what I just said, which is poppycock. But actually, the medical director for the Maricopa County Department of Health, and I'm not making up this name at all, Dr. Rebecca Sonnenschein, said, quote, "Even with extreme heat like we saw this summer, these deaths are preventable. This tragic record reminds us that as a community, we have more work to do to prevent these deaths." Okay. Apparently, Phoenix had the three hottest months since record keeping began in 1895. And as we all know, they've been measuring temperatures exactly the same and just as accurately for those 130 years. The average over those months was 97 degrees F over those three hottest months. And just so you know how much more deadly 2023 was, the previous hottest month's record was set in 2020 with a temperature of 96.7 degrees F. That's 0.3 degrees F hotter. And they expect humans to survive in this? I don't think so. They also set a record in July with a 31-day streak of daily highs at or above 110 degrees F. And I'll admit, that's hot, but at least it's a dry heat. So I'll be honest. I compared some various graphs of different years of daily and average temperatures for Phoenix from 1950 through 2023, and just like the sea ice, they aren't different. Some months have days a little higher, some a little lower, but except for a handful of days both high and low throughout the year, the average temperatures stay within a certain boundary. Now, I know they want to decry these record-breaking whatevers, but the reality is that year after year, everything basically stays the same. And that's why our record heat was only 0.3 degrees F different. That's why they must make 1.5 degrees C critical to our survival. See, if they instead reported that Phoenix had record heat for a three-month average, but it was only 0.3 degrees F higher, so really nothing to get alarmed about, then people wouldn't get alarmed. They just carry on with life and never give it a second thought, kind of like they do every single day, except when they're being shouted at by climate alarmists. But the oh-so-classy, illustrious, and quite obviously fraudulently elected governor of Arizona, Katie the Hammer Hobbs, has a new appointee to command. As given to her by the health department, Mr. Dr. Eugene Liver was given the role of the state's chief heat officer. Katie, the habitual liar Hobbs, has an extreme heat preparedness plan, and Dr. Liver holds a critical role in dealing with heat. And thank goodness, because if there's one thing we know, Arizonians, Arizonites, Arizoniacs have never had to deal with heat, ever. If only there was something that could be done to make it so people didn't have to just live outside in the extreme heat just all of the time. But alas, hopefully Dr. Liver can think of something. Now I jest, but there's actually nothing wrong with someone appointed to dealing with heat waves in hot areas. Think Arizona, Oklahoma, Texas, and the like. Or in the South, you've got Mississippi, Alabama, Florida. Just as has always happened, at least in general recorded history, places in the U.S. get hot at certain times of the year. So we have homeless people, we have those living in poverty, we have the elderly who are disproportionately affected, etc., etc., who are more adversely affected by the heat. I actually find nothing wrong with putting programs and systems in place to help those that need help. But of course, everything is couched in the theory, unprovable as it is, that everything is just getting hotter and hotter and we're headed for our demise. As the article states, these heat offices are there to, quote, protect people and the overall community from extreme heat as climate change leads to more frequent and enduring heat waves. Uh-huh. Not heat waves. More frequent and enduring heat waves because of you wanting to drive a regular car, you monster. But when we're talking about saving lives due to extreme heat, we should probably ask the question, is hotter better or is colder better? Because most of the U.S. has seasons of hot and cold. And since humanity apparently has the godlike ability to control the climate through our cars puttering around, completely trumping volcanoes, oceans, and the sun, we need to ensure we're making wise choices. Back in the 70s, only 50 years ago, the exact same people that are telling us that we're going to die from heat today were telling us that we were all going to die from cold back then. All the data, and I mean all the data, clearly showed that we were heading into another ice age. Oh, silly data. But if we say the planet must be cooler in the hot months, that means it's also going to be cooler in the cool months. If we suck all the carbon out of the air, besides plants not growing, which means we can't feed ourselves or feed livestock, so, you know, there'd be mass death due to starvation and whatnot. But ignore that conspiracy. If we suck all the carbon out of the air and the planet starts to cool, how do we make sure we don't go too far? If 1.5 degrees C higher is heat death, is 1.5 degrees C lower cold death? Well, looking at an article on Weather Underground entitled, Which Kills More People, Extreme Heat or Extreme Cold? We get the definitive scientific answer to that question. And the answer is, drumroll please, yes. This article is from 2019, but clearly shows, per the National Weather Service, a division of the NOAA, in 2017, 107 people in the entire U.S. died from heat, with a 30-year average of 134 per year in the U.S. And only 26 people died from cold in 2017, with a 30-year average of 30 per year. And let me pause here and say that if in 2017 only 107 people died from heat across the entire United States, but in 2023, more than 425 people died from heat in Maricopa County, Arizona alone, I have questions about counting. Maybe the lovely, sophisticated, weaselish, illegitimate Governor Katie Hobbs is mandating they use Common Core counting techniques or something. I don't, because these numbers don't make sense. Back on topic, the NWS clearly shows that heat is the killer by more than four times. However, per the CDC data, also cited in this article, from a 2014 study, twice as many deaths, 1,300, from 2006 to 2010, were attributed to cold, while 670 were from heat. And I still have that question about the Maricopa County data, but no need to kick that poor dog again. Just kind of curious. Along the same lines, an article from Forbes, which in general is considered a fairly centrist news source, from July of 2023, has the headline, Excessive Heat Can Kill, but Extreme Cold Still Causes Many More Fatalities. Well, so that's not good. They state that heat is considered more of a silent killer, as it's not as obvious. Generally, it takes more analysis of the data to determine if a death is heat-related, although knowing how deaths during the COVID pandemic were classified, I'd have to again question agenda with regard to this classification and counting. That said, this article claims that the planet warmed about 0.9 degrees F from 2000 to 2019 and resulted in an increase in annual deaths disproportionately impacting Asia, Africa, Southern Europe, and Southern North America. They further state that often these heat-related deaths have other underlying contributors like age, heart issues, blood pressure issues, etc., etc., etc. But then they pivot. According to a 2021 study from The Lancet, quote, cold is far more deadly. This study said that for every death that was attributed to heat, there are 9 deaths attributed to cold. 9 to 1. Again, underlying conditions have a big effect, but the ratio is the story here. In fact, they go back to the period from 2000 to 2019 when the planet warmed by 0.9 degrees F, allegedly, and said that yes, heat deaths did rise, but cold deaths fell, and cold fell faster than heat rose. And likely for a number of factors, but in that time period, they estimated that 650,000 fewer people died due to temperature than in the 20 years prior to that, the 1980s and 90s. They then discussed the discrepancy between the NWS and CDC data that I just mentioned a few minutes ago and said that, quote, discrepancies in definitions and assumptions around measurement underlie each organization's calculations of cold and heat-related deaths. Yeah, It appears so. And frankly, I wouldn't buy into either one of them, as they're both government funded. The Lancet, it seems to be more, not completely, but more neutral of a source. But of course, as we all know, Forbes has to give us a warning, quote, "However, we shouldn't read into this that global warming is a good thing. Climate change has long-term impacts on sea levels, animal and plant life, and agriculture, each of which can have lasting, deleterious effects on human health and well-being. Also, heat exposure deaths disproportionately impact impoverished regions of the world, including poor areas of the U.S., which implies that, over time, they're much more affected by temperature-related deaths." And sure, fine, that's fine. I'm fine with that. We're all fine here. But again, I'd say 9-1. And just as in the 1970s, when we were told that the data showed it was getting colder on a straight line, and if we don't do something, we'll all die from the next ice age. And from what I can remember, and granted, I was fairly young at that point, that never happened. But we're at a time now that we're told that all the data shows it's getting hotter on a straight line, and if we don't do something, we'll all die from the earth frying to a crisp. And I wouldn't believe them now any more than I would have believed them before. The reality is they have no idea what they're talking about. And they never have. But let's take the Lancet study at face value. Cold kills at a ratio of 9-1. And a 0.9 degree F rise in temperature has resulted in 650,000 fewer deaths. Then why would we want to lower the global temperature again? Now, I don't know what the correct temperature of the Earth is supposed to be, but then again, they don't either. But it seems to me that if we have data that says a warmer planet, to a point, is better, why would we want to go the other direction again? But really, as I've said before, this creation is built on frequencies, oscillations, vibrations. Everything in all of creation has its own natural frequency. We even see this in the book of Ecclesiastes. Quote, "There's an appointed time for everything, and there's a time for every matter under heaven." Now listen to this list. "A time to give birth and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. A time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. A time to search and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear apart and a time to sew together. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. And a time for war and a time for peace." Now these are all opposite ends of the spectrum, but depending on where you draw your boundaries, they're all cyclical. There's a time to sow and a time to reap, and then a time again comes around to sow, and so on and so on. You ever lost your keys, and then found them, then lost them again? And we see the same kind of cyclical action, say, in the kingdoms of Israel. Evil king, good king, etc., etc. We all have ups and downs in our own lives. Every place on earth has seasons, some much less pronounced than others, but we all have seasons. We can watch the tide come in and go out. The sun rises, then sets, only to rise again. To think the global temperature, the oceanic temperature, the Arctic ice level, and the pH of the oceans are any different is nothing but foolishness. It's silly to think that those things, out of everything in all of creation, should be a nice, steady, straight line with no deviation. It's just as foolish to think that those things will bow to the arbitrary boundaries that we say they should exist within. And that's actually what the graphs and the data show. There's cyclical fluctuation to all of these things, and that's what we see in just our very limited data. We really have no idea what temperature this planet should be, or the correct temperatures of the oceans, or the ideal amount of sea ice, or the correct pH level. Even more so, we're crazy to think that there is a so-called perfect point for all of these aspects of the planet. We have no idea how hot is too hot, or how cold is too cold. We have no idea how hot or cold this planet should get before the temperature trend breaks over and starts heading the other direction again. And to be honest, we don't need to know. God knows. In fact, God doesn't just know like some passive observer. God ordains. The amount of Arctic ice that we have at this very second is exactly the amount of Arctic ice God ordained us to have at this very second. Before he created the first molecule, he ordained that. As I've said before, the caveat is that we're not here to just decimate the planet, right? We're here to manage and use the planet. And we don't need to worry about using it up. Animals that were hunted into extinction, as far as we know, were ordained to that end. for whatever God's purpose was. But if you've noticed, the planet did not crack in half because the dinosaurs disappeared or the dodo no longer does whatever the dodo did do. The combination of man and nature has destroyed massive amounts of forest and rainforest, used conventional and nuclear weapons in various places, either through testing or in actual war. We've had huge, deadly, toxic industrial accidents. We've massively polluted. We've pumped some really nasty stuff into the atmosphere. Millions of animals and people have died due to various plagues and pandemics. And we've been about as unsanitary as a little closed unit of people as you could possibly imagine. And yet humanity thrives. The planet is greener than it's ever been, in modern history at least. The water cleans itself. The air cleans itself. It's almost like someone or something has got the whole world in his hands and designed it and maintains it so that all of these things, not one of them, a surprise to him, will not stop the planet from rotating. See, the globe will cycle back down in temperature again, if we're even measuring accurately right now, which I have massive doubts about that. And the environmentalists will claim victory. And the climate alarmists will start shouting about the inevitability of another global ice age. Man will just keep jumping from one crisis to the next. Politicians will spend massive amounts of money to combat impending doom. Global power brokers will reset and figure out how to capitalize on the latest fear, because without a biblical worldview, without God at the center of your world, you're literally clinging to the rocky surface of an evolutionary miracle hurtling through space, clinging to fragile existence, relying on others to keep you safe. Nobody with a biblical worldview should ever succumb to climate alarmism. We fearlessly stay the course. We work on personal sanctification. We grow our fruits. We share the gospel. And we rest in the fact that God has got you and me, brother, you and me, sister, and the whole world in his hands. Somehow, this is goal update number 3 for 2024. That means that we're nearly done with the first quarter of 2024, and I'm not sure how I feel about that. A little panicky, I think. Kind of tired. Very old. Pretty sad. Mostly hungry. Anyway, I guess we need to look at these goals. After all, that's why we're here, right? You know, play us a song, Mr. Piano Man, I hear you shout. Fine. Here we go. All right, starting with the accursed weight. The reality is that I have not yet taken this diet thing seriously. I've been generally managing calories. I have been working out, so I've actually gone down in weight about 1.8 pounds since the last update. That's what I could and should do on a weekly basis. But like I said, I was going to do at the end of last year. I'm going to try to put weight loss on a nice low and slow burn. You know, per my goal, I'm way behind. Overall, I'm down 4.6 pounds from the beginning of the year. The weekly progress is slow, but I'm okay with it. My fat percentage has dropped 0.2% since the last update. Muscle has gone up by 0.2%, so that's progress as well. I've also been tracking calories in my nifty spreadsheet, and I've cobbled together a theoretical calorie burn. Basically, it appears I'm burning a daily average about 1,950 calories or so. That's with working out, which, if that's correct, doesn't that seem a little low? Like, when I say that my metabolism stopped in college, maybe that's not a joke. That just seems low to me. But I'll keep tracking things, because if there's one thing I love, it's a spreadsheet. So this goal is obviously red. Not angry at it, though, which is probably a bad thing overall. But we'll see if I can pick up the pace somewhat, at least for the next update. At this current rate, I'd be hard-pressed to get to my goal by the end of the year. So I do need to pick it up. But progress is progress. Okay. Reading. That's a much better achievement and much better goal thus far. The reading during lunch, the thing that I've worked out, has been working out fantastically. So far, I've had only 1 week that I didn't get my weekly goal of 88 pages read, and that was a week where we had 3 days of audits at work, so my schedule was kind of jacked up. Incidentally, that was also a very bad calorie week, because free lunch those 3 days, and what am I going to do, not eat it? Anyway, as of this update, I'm sitting at 1,667 pages read so far this year out of the goal that I've set for the year of 4,500, so I should be somewhere around 22% of my annual goal, and I'm actually currently at 37%. So we're well ahead of the pace. I finished up 8 books so far, and I'm currently in 2 others. One I'm over halfway done, and the other one I'm just at the beginning of. This goal, solid green. And since I'll be updating you on the books I've read again soon, no need to go any deeper into this one here. So moving to Bible reading. Again, getting up early and doing my Bible study is working out pretty well. Better than I actually thought it was going to work out, if I'm being completely honest. I've only had 1 week that I didn't meet my goal of 5 days per week reading. And that one was 4 days I got that week. The only problem I've got is that I'm probably staying up too late again. I'm trying to time out how to get a workout in and watch my Cubs game while working out usually, and trying to get the timing so that I'm cooled down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so I can get on my knees, do my prayers, get into bed at a reasonable time, and trying to get up at 5, that means I should really try to be lights out by like 11 or 11:30, but it's trending more like midnight. I've got work to do there. Anyway, for the year, I'm at 116% of my goal for my reading, currently through Joshua 5, which remember, I'm doing this chronologically, so a couple Psalms are thrown in there, the book of Job is in there as well. For the very, very slow in-depth reading, also chronological, I'm in Job 9, so really slow, mostly due to the fact that I only do that maybe once or twice a week out of all my Bible reading. So, yeah, I'm focusing more on the regular reading. As with book reading, I'll be filling you in on this yet again in the near future. So for now, this goal's a solid green. We can move on. Okay, learning Greek through Duolingo. Here's the thing. Those foreigners speaking their gibberish, that's hard to learn. That said, I've had 2 weeks with my minutes being in the 60s, just under my goal of 70. The other weeks have all been over 70. But overall, I'm sitting at 173% of my goal for the year, but that was heavily loaded towards the first few weeks. I haven't missed a day so far, so I've got the all-important streak going of, I don't know, I think I'm like at 93 or 94 days or something like that. I don't think I could speak Greek right now. Like hardly at all, maybe a few words here and there. But I do know some words by sight pretty well. I'm recognizing the patterns of gender and verb tense better than I was before, so that's good. My mind doesn't work like this, I'll just be honest. So it's going, it's slow and steady, but it's going. There is progress here. Next is my prayer life. So I've had 3 weeks where I haven't hit my knees at the end of the day and spent time in focused prayer at least 5 days per week. One of those weeks I was sick and I was just exhausted. But the other 2 weeks, well, those come back to me trying to get my timing in the evening figured out with working out and watching my all-important Cubs game and getting to bed on time, etc., etc., right? It's not a good excuse, but it is true. I know to some this sounds pitiful. Not able to spend focused time a mere 5 days out of the 7-day week. I spend it 9 days out of the 7-day week. Yeah. But I know for some, like I've definitely been in the past, we talk a good game, but we never follow through, right? You know, oh, you're in my prayers if I ever do that again someday in the distant future. And that's why I'm putting this out front here, right? I want some sort of accountability here. The plan or the system or whatever you want to call it that I've got going, that's actually going pretty good. I just need to make sure that I'm not dragging myself toward the bed in the evening. I need to be awake enough and alert enough to actually pray and not do that whole sleep pray thing, right? So for right now, although I've had a few hiccups along the way, this goal is a solid green. Okay, finally, memorizing the book of Romans. I'm close. I've almost got it all. But at the same time, I'm not even remotely close. And I'm actually probably a few verses behind the pace I've set for myself. I should be up through verse 26 of chapter 1 by now, but I'm probably more back at like verse 23. At least that's where I feel most confident. So I've got some catching up to do, and I absolutely know where in my day I have time to do that. I just need to do it. Now, as I said before, a few years back, I had memorized up through the first part of chapter 3, so a lot of this right now is fairly easy to re-memorize. So I should be able to catch up pretty easily, at least for now. Now, we'll just kind of have to see how this goes as time goes on, right? This is going to get really tough and really time-consuming the deeper I get into it. I'll be honest, I'm just not really sure about this goal right now. It's kind of the one that I set that I would say is really kind of up in the air. For now, I'll soldier on. We'll kind of decide what to do with this in the future. Okay, so that's where I am. Where are you? Hopefully you're tracking your progress on your goals, and hopefully your progress is tracking on your goals. As always, if you have any comments or questions or ideas, tips or tricks or whatever, just let me know. If you want to tell me where your goals are for the year and how you're doing, that's fine too. If you haven't set any goals for the year, still not too late. Never too late. You can start setting and working on goals anytime. Doesn't have to be on January 1. It can be anytime. Just set the goal and track the goal. Okay. Goal update number 3, 2024 edition in the books. So with that, okay, bye. And with that, sadly, we've reached the end of yet another episode of the Logical Christian Podcast. I feel we've bonded as we've laughed and cried and twisted our faces in incredulity. If you've enjoyed or found value in what you've heard, go on and do all the podcast things. And don't forget to check the show notes for links and contact info. Lawrence J. Peter said, "Against logic there is no armor like ignorance. Jesus told us that if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." So stay in the word, stay logical, stay faithful, and until next time, God bless.